The Secrets of Doctor Who is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss everything about the hit BBC series Doctor Who. And today we're discussing the fifth Doctor story, Warriors of the Deep. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Stika. Hey, Father Corey.
How's it going?
And Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
Folks, be sure to get your very own Secrets of Doctor Who t-shirt or phone case or notebook or sticker or more by visiting sqpn.com/merch. We can also get merch related to all our other shows, like this, if you're watching the show, Secrets of Middle-Earth shirt I'm wearing, which has a secret message in Elvish on the shirt. So you can
be sure to drink your Ovaltine,
Something like that. It's actually the Hail Mary in High Elvish, as written by J.R.R. Tolkien himself. So check out all of our merch, Doctor Who merch, especially at sqpn.com/merch. Stick around to the end of the show. We have more of your great listener feedback on our recent episodes. And I want to tell you about another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy called Let's Science. And you can find that wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/science. So, Jimmy, can you give us a recap of Warriors of the Deep?
This week, the Third Doctor haunts the Fifth Doctor. Two of the Third Doctor's main antagonists, the Silurians and the Sea Devils, team up. The Fifth Doctor, Tegan, and Turlough arrive in 2084 at a military sea base. At the time, the Earth is divided into two big power blocks that are on the brink of a devastating war, and the alliance of the Silurians and the Sea Devils wants to take over the military base so that they can shoot proton missiles into space and explode them. This will cause the two human power blocks to go to war and exterminate each other, after which the Silurians and Sea Devils can rule the planet. The Doctor is desperate to find a way to avoid this destruction, and he appeals to the Silurians and Sea Devils' noble natures. But after their previous experiences with humanity in the Third Doctor's time, they're not having it. Ultimately, the Doctor releases a gas that is fatal to all reptiles and makes their faces melt like Nazis in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And the Silurians and Sea Devils kill all the humans except for the Doctor and his companions. So the world is saved, and just for once, everybody dies. but the Doctor says there should have been another way. The end.
All right, Father Corey, your overall impression of this one?
So I was thinking as I was watching this, like, I don't remember this story. And, you know, watched a lot of Peter Davison stories as I was growing up and everything. And, well, there's a reason for that. It's a boring paint-by-numbers, Cold War analogy, base under siege story. And by the way, Jimmy, not everybody died. There's like the one, like the second command survived. He was the one that was pumping the gas. I don't think he got shot.
I think everybody died.
I thought everybody died.
I thought he, because there was like one scene where they show him switching tanks and that's the last you see of him, but perhaps not. But either way, maybe he died too and we just didn't see it, or at least I missed it. But again, it was a boring
paint by numbers. Let's kill him anyway. Let's agree to kill him.
It would be easy to miss. They killed the sea base commander at the last minute, saying he just keels over and they say he's been shot and no one shot him.
Exactly. So it's
let's just shoot them all.
Yep. Yeah. So, like I said, it's a boring paint by numbers, base under siege, Cold War analogy story. I didn't remember it because it wasn't memorable.
How about you, Jimmy?
Well, I did remember it. And if I were to summarize it in just a few words, I'd say cool title, ridiculous monster. Because this story is famous for having a monster that looks absolutely ridiculous. The monster is called the Murka, and it's an underwater creature that has been modified by the Sea Devils genetically, and it's basically a pantomime lizard horse centaur electric eel thing. But it really looks like a pantomime horse that's green. Now, pantomime is something that they have in Britain that we don't really have so much in America. But in Britain, it's a Christmas tradition where you have pantomime performances and, you know, you'll have two guys in a ridiculous looking horse costume that looks very little like a horse. And it's very hard for British people, as soon as they see anything pantomime, because it's played for comedy, they have trouble taking it seriously. Mm-hmm. And so the pantomime lizard horse in this was infamous. And even worse, one of the actresses who it kills, the character it kills, when she confronts it, she starts to do martial arts moves. I mean, she's like holding her hands in this martial arts position as she's about to take on this lizard. And then she gives it a kick, which is completely ineffectual and also the thing she needs to not do because it's an electric eel thing. Mm-hmm. And so she electrocutes herself and dies. And in making the costume, everybody hated this monster. The writer hated it. He said, I did not describe this monster this way. And I didn't say it was a quadruped or anything like that. But they had so little time that they were literally working on the costume up to like half an hour before filming it. And so the glue and the paint are not even dry, and you can see it like marking the walls with paint when it lumbers against them. And the martial arts kicking electrocution scene was so bad that executives at the BBC played it as justification for, we want to get rid of this show. Now, they didn't at this time get rid of the show, but this episode, this story is infamous for the Mirka. Having said that, it's got some interesting concepts in it. They're trying, and some of the siege I thought was reasonably executed. There's some good acting that's genuinely tense on the part of the human actors. Of course, you don't really get that from the Silurians and the Sea Devils because they've got electronically altered voices and they're in these bulky costumes, so you can't see them emoting or anything. But I thought some of the human tension during some of the assault on the base was actually good. But there's a lot of paint-by-numbers stuff. There's a lot of running around in corridors. There's a lot of overacting and things like that. And so, yeah, it's not great. But it has a cool title. Warriors of the Deep is a great title.
It's a good title. So for my part, first time watching it, like you said to me, there's some interesting concepts, some interesting ideas. Some of the guest actor acting is pretty good. I kind of like the commander of the base. Mm-hmm. The side story of the midshipman or cadet or whatever it was who forced into this vital role and is being undermined by, Soviet moles or whatever they are, whatever the mm-hmm. other power block is. Some of that was pretty interesting and pretty good. So I like that. But yeah, the flaws far outweigh the good things in this. And we'll I definitely want to get into some of those. It was interesting that both Peter Davison and Janet Fielding announced their departures from the show during the filming of this.
Apparently coincidentally, but one has to wonder.
Yeah. It probably wasn't helped. Let's just put it that way. Is this the first adventure for Turlough after his change of heart? The Five Doctors.
Yeah, right. But you might be forgiven for thinking it's his first adventure after he stopped working for the Black Guardian, because the Doctor at the beginning of this treats him like with real suspicion.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like as if the five Doctors didn't even happen, which is interesting.
Well, he doesn't remember it because of wibbly wobbly timey wimey,
of course,
out of timeline, whatever. No, I'm kidding.
So we have the return, like you said, the return of the Silurians and the Sea Devils. Do the Silurians look very different than they did before?
Yes, they've redone the costumes.
Okay. And they don't have, we don't see Sea Devils at all for the first two, pretty much for the first two episodes of the four parts. And the Silurians don't even really have very much to do at all except reactivate the Sea Devils for those two. So we only really have these antagonists for two of the four episodes.
And it's not even clear what they want to do. I mean, they're skulking around, but we don't get a clear explanation of their plan until, the third, maybe even the fourth, but it's at least in the third part. And it doesn't come from them. there's a moment where, because I've been noting, so what are they trying to do? And then finally, Tegan says, so Doctor, what are they planning to do? And he says, obviously they want to capture the base and shoot missiles into space and cause a war between the humans. And
it's obviously.
Like, okay, well, what they were doing, we knew they wanted the base and they wanted it intact, but that's all we knew. Mm-hmm. So thanks for the exposition, but it would have been nicer if we could have pieced it together from them.
Right.
Yeah.
I did not like, you mentioned the voices, like the of the Silurians and the Sea Devils. The way that in this era they do the modulation of voices, making it even harder to understand the dialogue. But the Silurians, I mean, the Sea Devils on top of it are whispering everything.
Yeah.
Stop whispering.
Yeah. Like,
and then the actors in the suits are walking around like toddlers with a full diaper. They have this weird like waddle going on. Like they just didn't seem menacing to me at all. Like, how are you being defeated by these guys?
Well, they do have powerful ray guns.
Yeah, that would be the only way. And the Merca. We have this jittery cadet and midshipman who's...
Yeah, he says he's a student.
Yes. Yep. So, yeah. So whatever that means.
And what he is he's subbing, he's training to be a sync technician, or sync operator. And that's what he does. He's got a port in his head, and he plugs into the computer and gives the computer instructions. So he's basically got a Neuralink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and he's training to replace this guy. He was an understudy for an actual professional sync technician who was mysteriously killed shortly before the story began. And so now he, just a student, has to step up and perform these vital functions, and he's kind of cracking under the strain.
It seems a bit of a flaw if your major weapon system is dependent on like one guy being...
that's why we have key man insurance in businesses, and also that's why you cross train in the military.
Well, and in this case, the person who syncs up the computer basically runs the computer with his mind. So he's using his mind to do all the calculations and everything, and it's like, well, that's what computers are powerful enough to do now. They can handle all of that. Every single bit of it.
I don't know why they actually need a sync tech. If you want to, because all they're doing is running a sea base. Okay, so that's routine life support, and occasionally they have missile drills, and he would be needed as one component of launching the missiles. Mm-hmm. But we have ways of doing that now. If you want a sync tech, you need someone who has to neurally interface with the computer to do stuff. You need to give me something more sci-fi to justify that.
Well, it's like a fail-safe to make sure that the missiles can't be launched by the computer alone. That's how they express it. But it's still just kind of like, okay, we've had that for a very long time. It's called two people with keys.
Yeah.
Same result.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have two people, like, instead of just one.
And they don't have to be doing just that job of turning the key. They can be doing other jobs like maintenance or being the commander. And then, oh, by the way, get up here and turn your key. Okay.
Right. I mean, they do, you know, work to have several layers of things going on, because it's not just, you know, an invasion of the base by the undersea, you know, the Silurians and Sea Devils. But you also have these two moles working to destroy the base.
Well, they're undermine it and disable it. Because what they do, so one of them is the second in command. And the other is the base's physician. So you've got Dr. Solo. Solow. Yeah. Played by Ingrid Pitt. She's the one who does the martial arts on the Merca.
Karate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other guy is Nilsson, and he's the second in command. He's the evil second in command. And they're apparently working in the novel. They identify, they never say who the two blocks are in the story, but they're obviously meant to, the Cold War never ended. It's the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc. And they use those names in the novel. And so they've both been won over by the ideology, apparently, of the Eastern Bloc. We don't know what that ideology is, but it won over these two people. And now they're serving as spies, basically. And they want to, the the computer interface guy, his name is Maddox. And so what they want to do is Manchurian candidate him. So he's got a port in his head, and the evil physician uses a computer disk to condition him so that he'll mindlessly obey their orders. And their orders amount to mess with stuff in the computer system. But I don't know why they need him, because he's alone in this room messing with the computer system and they're standing around watching him.
Yeah.
Why do you need the elaborate rigmarole of Manchurian candidating someone? Why don't you just mess with the computer stuff yourself?
Right.
I mean, nobody else is here and you're just standing around watching.
There's also some weird thing about that disc you mentioned. Everybody on the crew has a disc assigned to them that can mess with their head or something that can only be put in use by express order of the commander. Like, it is this has to be kept. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like a control. It's like a control mechanism where if necessary, they can control someone because reasons.
Yeah. Or maybe just it's the operating system, for the sync operator or something. That we don't get a good explanation. Yeah.
No.
So then introduce the Doctor and Turlough and Tegan into this whole mess, and they land on board. They're kind of shot down and
from space.
From space, land on board this sea base. Which before I talk about what they're doing, let's talk about the sea base a little bit. So the idea is that it's not a bad idea that you have a secret sea base where you have your missiles. And that would be the way to hide your missiles from the enemy.
Only in the real world we call those secret sea bases submarines.
Yep. Right,
and
because
they're
mobile. Can move around.
So this is basically a permanent submarine. This is literally basically you just take a submarine and you plant it on the sea floor and build around it.
I mean, we never got around to building sea bases in the Cold War. You know what I mean? That would have been kind of cool idea.
That you know of.
there are a few for scientific purposes.
Yeah, so this is one of the keys and that sort of thing. Yeah, but it would be, it was interesting. I was reading on the TARDIS Wiki, the writer, the way he described this sea base, the way it should look. It was supposed to be dingy, sort of a forgotten relic of this Cold War, and instead they made it look like something out of Space 1999, Star Wars, from one of the Rebel ship. It's bright white, big corridors, brightly lit.
It does become dingier when the Mirka starts lurching into the walls and marking them with green paint.
Yeah,
I know. No. the janitor's reckoning are going, who's going to get that mark out of there? But as he put it, in retrospect, it lost some of the tension and drama that you would have had if it were more like a submarine, I think is what he was going for, which is probably what they should have just done in the first place, just make it a submarine, but...
Well, brightly, most horror movies are not brightly lit, although I guess I've never seen it, but I guess Midsommar is one that is brightly lit that is still horrifying, apparently.
Right.
You know, it would kind of be like, was it a 10th Doctor or the one where they were in the Soviet submarine and the Ice Warrior was on board? Mm-hmm. Again, you had that aesthetic, that feel, that claustrophobic, sort of thing. So the doctor and Turlough and Tegan running around, and at one point they kind of get cornered over a moon pool, over like a pool of water, or I think it was a reactor pool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the doctor, falls, he does the Gandalf you shall not pass, and gets knocked into the water, and Turlough goes, well, he's dead, let's get out of here. He fell
get
in
back
the
to
water.
The
so Tegan and Turlough have the most bizarre opposite personality patterns in this. When the doctor gets captured, Tegan is like, we're going after him. And when Turlough gets captured, Tegan is like, we're going after him. So she's very active and aggressive in wanting to save her companions. Whereas Turlough is like, we can't do anything for this person. Let's go back to the TARDIS.
Yep.
Oh, well, we don't have the doctor anymore. He's right there. Maybe you can dive in for him.
That's the timing on that is ridiculous, because the doctor falls into the reactor pool and Turlough says, he's dead. And it's like, the Doctor can't hold his breath for 5 seconds because that's all it's been.
Yeah.
Fish him out and do resuscitative breathing on him.
We've literally seen him go out in space without a spacesuit. I think he can handle a little bit of water for a minute.
Yeah. Right. So then they escape by running out this door, and then Turlough does some electronic jamming of the door. He breaks the electronics that control it. I love, on the other side of the door, you have the sea-based personnel working on the door. And meanwhile, there's the security guy next to him banging on it with his fist. Like, why are you banging? Stop banging on the door, Hardy. It was distracting me. You think banging's going to open the door?
Also, the guards in this sea base, now everybody has sidearms, but there are mm-hmm. certain people who have rifles that are mm-hmm. that are guards, and I hope those, I don't know what those slug throwers are throwing, but firing a rifle in a submarine is not generally a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it can lead to explosive decompression, for example. Mm-hmm. Or implosion, actually, I should mm-hmm. say. But for some reason, the guards have these big plastic coveralls with big plastic transparent beekeeping hoods over them.
Yeah.
And it's like, what is the purpose of the hoods? You know, I mean, these suits, if you're on the bottom of the ocean, these suits aren't going to protect you much. But why would the guards need the plastic? Even if you say, okay, these are meant to pressurize and save their lives or something. If everyone else is walking around without them, why do the guards need them? You know, it makes no sense. But it does lead to a couple of nice bits of comedy. Because
My favorite part.
At one point after the Doctor, we have an underwater swim sequence with the Doctor where he gets out of the reactor pool. And then he comes across a guard that has been electrocuted by what Turlough did to the controls. Mm-hmm. And he senses his pulse and says he'll live. And then he takes the guy's guard suit. Yep. And puts it on so he can disguise himself and get into the bridge where he wants to go. And as soon as he puts on the beekeeping hood, he goes, oh, what have you been eating? and then when he meets up with Tegan on the way to the bridge, she greets him and she says, oh, what have you been eating?
Yeah.
That is a polite British euphemism for the Jew baskets.
That's actually not that polite.
Man, if you're sick, go to the infirmary, dude. That was pretty funny. That my inner 12-year-old was amused.
I mean, the whole idea that he disguised himself as a guard with the whole idea that he disguised himself as a guard with a clear plexiglass helmet.
No,
it's ridiculous.
It's not designed to pass close inspection. Interpret it as burps, though.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There's that.
Same difference.
Yeah. I'm less mature, so I would. So
when they're in the reactor scene, and they're under assault by the guards who are coming to get them, the Doctor does this. When I say run, 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 and it's like there's no pause. You should have just said run.
Of course, that goes all the way back to Patrick Troughton.
The director should have had him pause for until a strategic moment to run.
Yeah, when I say run, run. Well, so if he hadn't told them that, he would just sort of said run, and they would have said, "You mean now? Move my legs fast?" Well, there's that after the Doctor has taken the jumpsuit from the unconscious soldier and left with Tegan. He's left him laying there on the floor in his underwear, and another group of soldiers just walk past. They looked at it that doesn't look odd to you. does Bob often pass out in his underwear in the hall? it was just such weird direction in this episode.
Johnny's drunk again, laying on the floor.
I do like when the Doctor finally gets into the bridge, which is where they're holding Turlough. At this point, and the guard, since the Doctor has a guard's uniform and equipment, he's got a rifle, and he comes in, and the station commander, whose name is Vorschach, I think, Vorschach, he's thinking the Doctor and Tegan and Turlough may be Eastern Bloc spies, And this isn't unreasonable because he's got a couple of Eastern Bloc spies on his staff that he doesn't know about.
Yep.
You know, they've showed up out of nowhere on a military base. What are you doing here? They tell this fanciful story about being travelers. One of them essentially says, so like you're tourists who have accidentally stumbled into a secret military base.
Pretty much.
And so they're thinking they're spies and who are here to do sabotage. And in fact, they're right because the doctor sabotaged their reactor to create a diversion. Mm. And they never really deal with this. They're asking Turlough about, well, then if you're just tourists who are here, why did the doctor sabotage our reactor? And he says, if the doctor wanted it destroyed, it would be in pieces at your feet. And that's all the closure. No, dude, why did he do it?
Right.
Not was he trying to destroy it. What was the purpose of the sabotage? Yeah. And that would be, well, so we could distract you and so forth and get back to our TARDIS or something. But in this highly suspicious set of circumstances, the doctor barges onto the bridge with the rifle. And I actually like what he does. I think the surrounding stuff is all ridiculous. But he says, what's the exact quote? I've got it here. He says, maybe it's time for a little mutual trust. And immediately pitches the rifle in a fairly safe way to the station commander.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, here, I'm disarming myself. That should earn us at least a little bit of trust. And it does earn enough trust that the station commander is not completely unreasonable and inflexible. He starts to consider whether there may be some truth to the doctor's claims. And he sends his underlings to go investigate the TARDIS, which has for some reason been left unlocked.
I was thinking that.
and the one of his underlings and a couple of guards just barge into the TARDIS. They're wandering around. They see how big it is on the inside. But eventually they come back and say, yeah, that's nothing from this world. They're telling the truth.
Yeah.
And so that's nice. You know, they're clearly not Eastern Bloc. They've got a UAP right over there.
Yeah.
It looks like a police box, but still it's a UAP. Yeah. I thought it was weird that they could just walk right in. I'm like, oh, they're going to get to it and it's going to be locked. And what? Like, they just got in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And leave a note for time travelers. Do not leave your TARDIS unlocked. People could get into it and do all kinds of bad things.
What makes this ridiculous too?
Yeah,
what makes this ridiculous, too, is, okay, this is the one story where they're always trying to get back to the TARDIS. They're actually like, no, we got to get back to the TARDIS. We got to get out of here. And they can't. How many stories, all they would have to do is get back to the TARDIS and they'd be done. It wouldn't have been an issue. And now this is the one where someone just wanders in because they left the door open.
Right. It just, So all of that, you know, gets set aside, you know, the suspicion of the doctor, mostly when the Silurians and Sea Devils do eventually attack in the third episode. And they send the Murka first.
Well, actually, they've already attacked, but the people on the base didn't realize it. There's in episode one, the people on the base send out like an underwater probe and the Silurians destroy it. And so the people on the sea base know that their probe has been destroyed. Originally, there were supposed to be footage of people inside the probe, but that didn't make it to screen. And we presumably would have seen them dying and like sending a message. We don't know who we're being attacked by or something, but that didn't end up happening. So they know that their probe has been destroyed, but they don't know by whom. So we do see that, but I wanted to mention it because of the footage. We see this Silurian sub moving around like the crater where the sea base is and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the effects are so bad
that
I'm going, is this meant to be underwater or is this just bad outer space effects? Because on a show like this, you've got craters with bases on them on other planets in the vacuum of space with little probes flying around them and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they don't quickly tell you this is all underwater. And I think they needed to signal like with seaweed or fish or something that this is actually underwater, and they don't, because we just had a scene with the doctor up in outer space getting shot at. And this could be in outer space too, for all I know. It's just because of my knowledge of the story, I can deduce this is underwater, but the special effects don't tell you that.
No.
There's a weird bit of dialogue too, because like they're getting these readings and it's like, you know, we've lost it, Commander. It seems to be organic in structure. Really? Because it's a ship of some sort. And then they like, it could be volcanic debris. Also not organic. It's, yeah. That's a rock. It's kind of a weird flaw in the writing. But yeah.
A flaw in the writing? And most of the stories are a flaw in the writing.
Yes, most of, but it's one of them. Anyway, the Merca shows up, and as we've mentioned, it's these ridiculous two guys in a horse suit, and I mean, it just looks so bad. But even just
It's technically a centaur, because in addition to the four legs, it's got two arms.
That's right. That's right. And the door, the airlock door breaks down, is obviously foam. Like, it is bending like foam rubber. It is so bad. Well, and then it falls on Tegan, and she's trying to push it off as if it's heavy, and it's like bending because it's foam.
And the doctor's like trying to lift it. Now, mind you, it falls on her foot, and the best she gets is a little bit of a sprained ankle.
Yeah.
You know,
she gets
just
a limp.
As she's running around in high heels the whole freaking episode.
Right.
But she's limping for about two scenes from this heavy door that falls on her until the Merca steps on it. Never mind, doesn't electrocute her when he does it.
Right. Well, it's foam. It's not electric. It's not conductive. Yeah. Well, speaking of the electrocution, it kills by touch. That's right. That's the only. It doesn't shoot electro beams, and it is so slow that no one should die. Like
run away.
Yeah. Instead, the soldiers run up to it and like, electrocute me next. Me next. Like well, step back and shoot. Like it was just so poorly directed. I'm sorry, but it's just so bad. It shouldn't have ever killed anyone.
Yeah, they do acknowledge that their weapons don't really affect it, but and the commander says, "Well, try."
Yeah.
But as long as you don't let it touch you, you should be okay. Except if you're touching something else. That's metallic that it's touching, because it does electrocute a whole bunch of people at once who are leaning up against a metal wall. I love the Merca's own vulnerability, though. The doctor deduces that because it was originally a creature of the deep before the sea devils messed with it, that it should not do well with suntan, with sunlight, and hopefully therefore it has no exposure to in its evolutionary history to ultraviolet light. And so he builds a really big, powerful suntan lamp and shines it on the Merca. And fortunately for him and the humans, the Merca is vulnerable to fatal suntans and it dies within seconds.
He sunburns to death. That's what he does. He sunburns to death.
Apparently so. Nielsen is also susceptible, because that's how he rescues Tegan from him.
Nielsen is a Scandinavian name, so you know they don't get a lot of exposure to sunlight up there.
That's right.
Those of us of Northern European descent feel this.
So he uses the bright light to blind Nielsen to save Tegan, and that's how they get away. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's actually the Merca that electrocutes Nielsen.
Right. Oh, right. No.
The sea devils burst in and start shooting, and they kill him over the body of the Merca.
Right. Because he's blinded. And he can't see them.
By the way, the sea devils in this, now this isn't true of the Silurians, but the sea devils are like, wow, I think they're turning Japanese. I really think so. Because they're wearing these samurai helmets and costumes.
Yeah. It was interesting to me that they kind of imply that the Silurians and the Sea Devils are two branches of the same race.
They're related.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that something we knew before?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I think they
said that in the first Sea Devils serial, where they established they were, because they'd already met the Silurians, and they established they're basically an underwater offshoot.
Okay. Yeah. The Sea Devils in the 12th Doctor, the 13th Doctor episode were very similar looking. And you know what? I think they could be an interesting villain if they brought them back. not like this, but in other ways.
So you mean not where literally the head of the alien is a hat on the actor?
It looks very clearly.
Everything
like
from the mouth up was a hat on top of the actor, and his head was at the neck.
And they got this big bulbous neck like a frog.
So, yes, yeah. They modified it from the original Sea Devils. They took they only had one of the costumes left. It was like on display. And so they had to make molds from it. And so they lost bits of it, like fins or stuff, but everything else they recreated. So the plan, the Silurian plan, is to make these two East and West Bloc go to war to kill each other off, but they won't directly cause they won't launch the missiles at the others because that would be wrong.
So this is fascinating. They're kind of like, so like on Deep Space Nine, Armin Shimerman always said he thought Quark was the most ethical person on the show because he's got a code and he lives by it. It's not a human code, but he's got a code. And similarly, the Silurians and the Sea Devils have a moral code that the Doctor appeals to try to get them to back off on this plan and just go back to their desire to want to share the world, which, you know, sets us up for the negotiations that happen in the Matt Smith time. But they've got this code that forbids it. Theoretically, it forbids killing, but they can kill defensively. And they've concluded we've been under attack by humans. And so what we're doing now is defensive, but we're not going to attack them directly. We're going to just provide a catalyst to let them kill each other. So they've found a way to Jesuitically square what their attempted genocide with their moral code, which is what all good genociders do.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and then the Doctor gets mad at the humans because we're wanting to fight back against the Silurians and Sea Devils. We're trying to wipe them out. Here's the line. I sometimes wonder why I like the people of this miserable planet so much. The Silurians and Sea Devils are noble races. They have skills and talents you pathetic humans can only dream about.
And then Turlough steps in and says, that doesn't alter what they're trying to do. And the Doctor goes, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. But still, like, they are trying to genocide all the humans, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're trying to do it by the nuclear version of stop hitting yourself. Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, basically, it really is, you know. We're not the one doing it because it's not our hand that pushes down on the touch panel. It's your hand being held there by our guards.
Oh, the hand for the touch panel. One of the fail safes, in addition to having a sync operator, the commander of the base also has to give a hand scan. And so they, a few times, you know, they apparently need his hand scan several times at different stages of the process. And at first he's like, I'm not cooperating with this. And the Doctor tells him, look, as long as there's life, there's hope, and they will kill you and use your hand if you refuse. So, nice to see that that's possible and could have been. Apparently the hand scanner doesn't detect blood flow. It's not one of those blood oxygen monitors.
Right.
But it's nice to see, they're brutal enough they would do that. And so he cooperates the first few times, but then when they're getting down to final launch, they're forcing him towards the panel and he's like, I will not cooperate in the destruction of my own kind. And he's got his hand out in front of him flat. Just ready to be put on the panel. It's like, dude, if you don't want to cooperate in the destruction of your own kind, make a fist.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, that whole finishing thing. And like, as you mentioned, he dies of nothing, apparently of a broken heart or something.
Well, they say he's been shot, but nobody shot him.
Exactly. When did he get shot? Because he's remarkably stoic about it.
Well, supposedly the last Silurian is pointing his gun at him and he says, Commander, watch out. And then he's standing there just fine, like nothing happened until, he dies, basically.
Yeah, he just keels over.
So,
I also like, so in they, in order to compensate for the fact that their sync operator is now dead, the humans are thinking that, well, the Sea Devils won't be – the Silurians won't be able to use the missiles because the computer requires both the hand scan and the sync operator to give the command. Mm-hmm. And the Doctor is like, dude, these guys have technology millions of years and more advanced than you guys. They will be able to compensate for this. And they do have a device, which they call the manipulator, that they hook up to the computer in place of the sync operator. And at one point, one of the Silurian technicians announces to Iktar, their leader, who the Doctor personally knows, although this character is not in the John Pertwee Sea Devil story, but the Doctor nope. says, I met you in a previous incarnation. But he tells Iktar, the Silurian guy tells Iktar, we're encountering computer resistance to the manipulator. So the computer is resisting the commands the manipulator is trying mm-hmm. to give it. And Iktar's solution is, he says, increase power. It's like, dude, I don't think you know how computers work. Increasing power is not going to get it to accept commands that it's rejecting.
That's the equivalent of the department saying, I'm trying to hack the Department of Defense computer, but the firewall is blocking me. Well, just give it more power. Just burn out the firewall.
The only time increasing the power would make sense is in that classic tech situation. Is it plugged in?
Uh-huh. Yes.
I mean, then increasing the power would make a difference. But otherwise, if it's rejecting your commands, increasing the power isn't going to do anything.
Any other, as you mentioned to me, everybody dies at the end, and the Doctor says there should have been another way. You think? Any other thoughts on this one episode, Father Corey?
Just a lot of, it was a bad story. I got a kick out of how, the beds were made futuristic by making the bed and then making a layer of bubble wrap over the top of the bed. That's a futuristic bed, is a blanket with bubble wrap on top of it.
It's entertaining.
Yeah. And then they end up killing off the Sea Devils and Silurians with a chemical called hexachromate, which are in these compressed bottles, standard like oxygen or carbon dioxide bottles. One gets pierced and it doesn't go boom or go flying around the room. Instead, it just shoots out a bunch of the gas. And so it wasn't pressurized or low just pressure. Pressurized. Yeah. Very low pressure. I don't know, but I looked it up. There is one guy that survived. The guy, his name was Bullock. He was the one that was in the red uniform. Orange. He's the only one who survived out of the entire crew.
Hmm. Okay.
Other than the companions.
The hexachromate is interesting. So with a name like that, I assume it's got like rings of six chromium atoms or something like that.
And apparently it's toxic only to reptiles.
To reptiles, but not mammals, so all the humans are safe. Yep. And it makes their faces melt, although we only get to see that happen once for presumably budgetary reasons. We get to see this, the first guard, the red shirt Silurian, who dies so that we can see how this stuff works. His face melts on screen. And it's all green and gooey and stuff, but then they don't have the budget to do that again. So when they're releasing the gas later, all the Silurians and Sea Devils turn their faces away from the camera
and just collapse. Yeah. Jimmy, any other thoughts?
So this was set, the Doctor says, around 2084, and it was released in 1984. So this is like 100 years from now, and it's their parable of imagine the Cold War continuing for another 100 years. Mm-hmm. And when really the Cold War is going to end in five years. They just don't know that.
Yeah.
This was a very unstable time in Russian politics. We had had, Brezhnev, after a fairly lengthy period as the premier of Russia, he had died. And then we had this quick succession of very elderly Russian leaders who were unstable. And this was a very tense time in the Cold War. At the end of 1983, we had the Abel Archer incident, which was a U.S. war games thing that almost led to a nuclear war. And actually, for people coming from a Catholic perspective, Sister Sister Lucy of the Fatima Revelations had, you know, requested that the Pope consecrate Russia to the Heart of the Immaculate of Mary Immaculate, and this was finally done by John Paul II, like right at this time. And afterwards, Sister Lucia said that if it had not happened, there would have been a nuclear war in like 1985 or 1986.
Wow.
But the consecration averted that. But that's just to give an indication of that and the Soviet leaders keeling over one after another and all the instability in Abel Archer. We were really close to nuclear war at this time. And so having a jump to 100 years later and seeing a similar scenario play out really resonated with the time that the people were living in when this episode came out.
Wasn't this about the same time as that famous miniseries about the day after?
Oh, that was, yeah.
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 That was not that. I was intrigued that a lot of people, including news commentators, now Carl Sagan is like a two-part miniseries.
Yeah.
Shown on a couple of consecutive evenings about what would happen if we had a nuclear war. And it was fairly realistic. And Carl Sagan was all up on the commentary shows they ran about it, you know, because they had discussions of it after the parts aired. And Carl Sagan was like, oh, see how horrible this is. And I was delighted to see some of the other commentators saying what I had thought upon seeing the miniseries, which is, well, the day after nuclear war ain't that bad.
Could have been worse.
Could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. But it was, people were like horrified by it. I mean, there was, you know, kind of visualizing massive attacks on cities and stuff. But yeah, it was not nearly, they didn't show it as bad as it could have been. But it was, it was very much in the public consciousness, the Cold War. I mean, this was really the height of the Cold War. And
it may be with the exception of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but yeah.
Right, but it kind of reached the climactic moment. Yeah.
The last big moment of the Cold War.
Right, and then Gorbachev got in 89, the Berlin Wall came down, and you know, things started to cool off a bit.
And the Soviet Union fell apart over Christmas, so that the cosmonauts up on the Russian space station came down to a country that didn't exist anymore.
Right. All right, so that said, I think that's all we need to say about the Warriors of the Deep, and let's move on to some feedback. Our first feedback comes from our Robots of Death episode. This was the fourth Doctor story. Dave on YouTube writes, "This was always one of my favorite Tom Baker stories. The costumes and makeup of the characters hinted of an interesting culture outside of the Mindcrawler. My favorite line from the story is, 'Please do not throw hands at me.'"
there's a great bit in Andy Hicks's Prydonian Rhapsody video of the Fourth Doctor, where in tune with Bohemian Rhapsody, there's a moment where Andy is singing. So we have these scenes in the video of the Fourth Doctor in all these situations, and he from the episodes, and he's offering a bag of jelly babies to the guy from this episode, and the lyrics is, "Do not throw your hands at me." And at that moment in the video, the guy slaps the jelly babies out of Tom Baker's hand, and it's just perfectly timed.
Yes, that was very good. Yeah, that is a good line, though. And then from The Mythmakers, the next episode, the first Doctor story, Mark on YouTube writes, "Back in the 80s, there were no telesnaps or animated versions of the missing episodes, so it was the Target novels to fill in the gaps. Yep. I love the novelization of this show. The puns are strong with it, and it reads as a comedy. Is There a Doctor in the Horse? Was the name of one chapter, and has stuck with me all these years."
Yeah, this one, it didn't really end up playing as a comedy. I think they meant it to, but it didn't come across that way in the end. However, we do have a First Doctor story coming up that is played for comedy, and it's the Gunfighters, where they go to the OK Corral.
I mean, there was some comedy in that one. You had Ulysses was pretty funny, and I do think there was actually aligned about, you know, there's a Doctor in the Horse, which was probably where that came from. So yeah, I do remember that. Our next
another thing that the Target novels did. I mean, like here, they're trying to overcome the shortcomings by amping up the comedy in the novel, you know, mm-hmm. which failed to translate onto screen.
Yeah.
But they also did a lot of other things in the Target novelizations to try to fix mistakes from the show, because they would the shows were made very quickly and released very quickly, and they weren't always, you know, people would point out plot holes and stuff. And so the writers of the Target novelizations of these same episodes would try to retcon problems and provide explanations mm-hmm. for things that the viewing audience had wondered about or objected to.
And then our next feedback comes from Matt on the same episode, and he says, concerning the feedback on past episodes, Jimmy is mistaken, how often can one say that, about the origin of the Doctor's distaste for pears. The true origin can be found in Human Nature, the Paul Cornell novel that he wrote in 1995 for the New Adventures book series, and later adapted for the 10th Doctor on screen in the episode of the same name. In the novel, it's the 7th Doctor who becomes human, watched over by everyone's favorite time-traveling archaeologist, Bernice Summerfield. The exact quote comes from the Doctor's instructions to Bernice of, things not to let me do. Number 4, eat pears. I hate pears. I don't want to wake up and taste that. However, given that the TV version was broadcast just before Blink, in which we learn about the general timey-wimey-ness of things, I think it's safe to assume that Tennant ad-libbed the comment about pears, Cornell heard it, liked it, wrote it into the postscript novelization of That Human Nature, and then the novelization fell backwards in time and ended up being published 13 years too early.
Well, that's one possible explanation. I also would point out that that just because a concept shows up in, because there are people who don't like pears, just because a concept shows up in a Target novelization does not necessarily mean that that's what inspired David Tennant to ad lib it when recording Blink.
Right, right. Maybe he just didn't like pears either. All right. So thank you all for your feedback. We do appreciate it. And
yeah.
We do want to now take a moment to thank our patrons and make it possible for us to create The Secrets of Doctor Who, including Tim H., Samantha K., Kristen R., Hiram G., and Todd N. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue The Secrets of Doctor Who and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And we'd also like to thank Simon Yannick, who edited this episode. So that's it from us. We would love to know what you think of Warriors of the Deep, and you can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com or the Secrets of Doctor Who Facebook page, or send an email to doctorwho@sqpn.com, or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. And you can watch The Secrets of Doctor Who on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia, where you can also leave a comment. We'll be back next time when we'll be discussing the 7th Doctor Big Finish story, The Rapture. Until then, Jimmy Yakin, thank you for joining me in sharing The Secrets of Doctor Who.
Thanks, Dom.
Father Corey Stiga, thank you as well.
Thank you, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who on StarQuest. And remember, what have you been eating?